Welcome to Raw Talk on M88. Call in with your questions or comments. Toll free 1-866-730-4921. Or submit your question to Dear DJ at M88.org. Now, it's time for some Raw Talk on M88.
And welcome to Raw Talk here on M88. I'm your host, Yo, joined by Mandy for yet another week of hopefully a conversation that will challenge you, encourage you, and most of all, get you to think. And actually, more than that, this week we want people to actually do something with what we talk about, as we talk about probably one of the key things that we need to be doing as Christians. We're going to talk about evangelism. Now, right there, I heard a bunch of radio dials click off like, whoa, little scary, don't want to get involved with that. I'm not ready for that phase in my life. So don't worry, we're going to try and make it a little less frightening for you, because this is something that we should all be doing, Mandy.
Definitely. And like you said, this is more than just a show getting people to think, which we do hope that it gets people to think.
Absolutely.
That's always a given for the show. But like you said, there's a challenge involved with this one, because it's not just about taking this to heart and, you know, saying, wow, that sounds like a great idea. We actually are called to do something about this. And like you said, we are going to be looking at how to make the actual process of evangelism a little bit less scary. Because let's face it, whether it's with your friends or your family or your coworkers or even a stranger that you run into on the street, it's kind of hard to approach people about this. And, you know, that's one of the things that we're going to be looking at tonight is why that is. You know, why is it so scary to evangelize?
Well, we have a very special guest on our show tonight, because this evening, our guest is from the future.
I'm pretty excited about this.
That's amazing.
I always wanted to talk to somebody about
it. I know. It's crazy. We're actually talking with Dr. David Geisler, who's in Singapore, and it's like 9 a.m. Monday morning in Singapore. So
it's tomorrow.
So it's tomorrow morning, and we're talking to him today, and I don't know how that works out, some sort of time flux capacitor thing going on there. But Dr. Geisler, thank you so much for joining us this evening. Really appreciate you sharing your time from the future.
Great to be with you.
Well, Dr. Geisler, David, before we get started, why don't you tell people a little bit about yourself and what you're doing there in Singapore?
Well, you probably know this, that I had the privilege of growing up as a son of a pretty well-known apologist, Norman Geisler.
Mm-hmm.
And so I learned apologetics from a very early age, but you know, one of the things that really bothered me, even as a little boy, is that you can go into all these Christian bookstores and see all these great books on apologetics and all these great books on evangelism, but hardly any on how to use apologetics in evangelism. So really the story of my life is really to, you know, I've been trying to apply basically what my father has taught me and apply it in the area of evangelism. And 10 years ago I was hired by Campus Crusade for Christ to develop a pilot program for graduate students, because they determined that a simple gospel approach wasn't working. And then about 5 years later I started my own ministry, because I realized graduate students were the only ones who were skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
And then 5 years ago God gave me a burden for Asia, and so I work here now teaching in 4 seminaries in Singapore and teach this model all throughout Asia.
Well, you're absolutely right. Using evangelism and apologetics together is something that a lot of people don't focus on. In fact, evangelism seems to be something that people just don't want to focus on at all. And it was very interesting, because here we are, we're doing this show today, and I'm at church this morning, unfortunately thinking about the show when I should have been paying attention to it, probably. But in our bulletins, we had some inserts, and one of them was a Focus on the Family bulletin for the month of March, and it was kind of interesting, because it had this story in it, and so I'm going to share this story just to kind of set the stage for what we're going to talk about. And here's the story. It's called A Kinder, Gentler Approach. It's by Elsa Kolopi, and it goes like this, just a short story. I'm going to talk to my friends about Jesus, my daughter Sammy announced after hearing a powerful sermon. Go get 'em, I said as she headed out the door. Maybe that was a poor choice of words, more football cheer than true spiritual encouragement. I should have equipped her with some real tools to help her friends. Hours later, my daughter returned home. I told Angela about Jesus, Sammy said, but she told me that he isn't real. What did you say? I said she'd be sorry if she talked about Jesus like that. Then she got mad. Sammy paused. So I got mad. Finally, I told her to love Jesus or else. And threatening her didn't draw her right to the heart of Jesus. Sammy looked at me. I smiled, then a small grin has spread across her lips. Yeah, probably not the best move. She started giggling. I laughed with her. Maybe we should come up with some different ways to tell your friends about him. Ways that show Jesus' love and heart for them. I do love your passion, though. Thanks, Mom, she sighed. I'll try not to beat up people to get them to accept Jesus. Lesson learned. And when I was reading that this morning, I was like, wow, that's kind of cool. That just feeds right into what we're going to talk about. When you hear a story like that, David, what's the first thing that comes to your mind when you hear something like that?
Well, I think one of the things that we need to do in evangelism is to change our definition of success in evangelism. I think for too long we've had the wrong definition of what success in evangelism is, and so we haven't had the right perspective. Our goal is not to share as much of the gospel to as many people as possible in the shortest time possible. Really, our goal should be to have a conversation with someone of a spiritual nature in such a way that the next time they see us, instead of running the other direction because they see us coming, they want to continue the conversation. And it seems to me this is a different kind of goal in a perspective in evangelism than maybe most of us have been taught. But, you know, if you look at Jesus and his life and the way he talked to people, for example, the woman at the well in John chapter 4, he didn't tell her to turn or burn, did he?
No.
He said things, he asked her questions and said things like this: if you drink of the water that I give you, you'll never be thirsty again. And that's what we need to do. We need to learn how to talk to our friends in such a way that they're thirsty for that living water, Jesus Christ. And unfortunately, most of us have not been taught how to do that. We've been taught how to simply, you know, proclaim the gospel and shove it maybe down their throats. But, you know, it just leaves a bad taste in people's mind and hearts and thoughts and mind if they see that it's something that we're trying to cram down their throat.
Well, 1-866-730-4921, if you'd like to join in to tonight's conversation. We're talking with Dr. David Geisler, one of the authors of the book Conversational Evangelism, which is a really good how-to book to approach this topic of evangelism, which is why we invited David to join us tonight. So if you got a question, or maybe you'd like to tell us, you know, what is it about evangelism that you find challenging or intimidating? You know, what is it that keeps you from evangelizing your friends and family? And, you know, if you got some concern about that, share it. Maybe we can help you overcome that obstacle. 1-866-730-4921.
Now, David, I have a question for you. You were talking about Jesus' response to the woman at the well and how it wasn't a turn or burn method. It seems to me, though, I mean, first of all, we know that that method really has never worked. I mean, you can look at history's time. That really has never worked.
Yeah.
But it seems to me like nowadays, and you talk about this a little bit in the book, it seems a bit more difficult now to talk to people, to approach people about this even, and their responses seemed a little bit more shut off. What are the reasons for those, do you think?
Well, I think we need to understand, Mandy, that we live in a world that's characterized by rejection of moral absolutes, deep skepticism, and an indifference towards truth. Gene Viith, in his book Postmodern Times, makes this important point. He says it's hard to proclaim forgiveness of sins to people who believe that sin's morality is relative. They have no sins to forgive. And that's what creates the difficulty today, and that's what I tell young people today is, look, the problems you're facing in talking to your friends today are much more difficult than when I was in college. Because not only do we live in a world characterized today by rejection of moral absolutes, deep skepticism, and an indifference or rejection of truth, but today there's also an intolerance towards those Christians who claim to know the truth. You see, for us as Christians to claim that Jesus is the only way sounds arrogant and intolerant. Now, when I was in college, and I was using the four spiritual laws, knocking on doors, I didn't have people thinking, oh, you're intolerant for sharing the gospel with me. And so I think we need to understand that the world has changed. And because of that, it's not so easy just to share a simple gospel presentation with people. Certainly the gospel may be simple, but giving to the gospel is not always so simple in the world we live in today.
There was actually a vivid example of just how much our culture has changed recently. Nightline did a Nightline face-off, a debate, where they debated the existence of Satan, whether or not the devil was real, whether or not there is such a thing as evil. Now, what was fascinating about this debate is that on one of the guys who were involved with the debate was a former bishop, actually a guy who called himself a bishop. I don't know if I'd refer to him myself. He himself still believes that he's a bishop, who still claims to be a Christian and all these types of things. But at the same time, this guy was on the side of saying there is no such thing as either the devil or evil, and that, you know, people aren't inherently good and all this type of stuff. And I'm thinking, whoa, how can you even define good in the absence of evil? I mean, it was a fascinating debate that it never even occurred to me that it would be a debate whether or not evil exists. And yet on this program, Nightline Face-Off, they were vigorously debating this, and from the reaction of the audience, there are a lot of people who are buying into this idea. Well, that whole thing about evil, that's just a figment of your imagination. That's just something created by intolerant Christians to make us feel guilty so that we'll fall into line with their own particular religious beliefs. I mean, it was a fascinating debate. We actually posted a link to it if you want to check it out for yourself at m88.org. And I'm going to guess you probably didn't get a chance to see it yourself, but you know, how do we overcome obstacles like that when we are in a world who doesn't even believe in evil anymore? How can you tell them they need to be saved from it?
Well, I think that's part of the problem, you know, is that we live in a postmodern world. In a postmodern world, there is no meta-narrative. There is no one story that really explains everything. And in a sense, even a lot of people are beginning to question whether reality really exists. I remember having a conversation with a college student on a college campus in the U.S. one day, and I was trying to talk to him about Jesus, and he didn't even believe he existed. Now, how do you have a conversation with someone that they don't even believe they existed? Now, if they don't believe they existed, I can certainly understand why some people may question whether Satan actually exists, whether evil actually exists. And that's the problem with postmodernism, is that postmodernism is the belief that there's no reality. Everything is a construct in its final form. And this becomes a big, big problem anytime we try to talk to people. And I think one of the things that we need to do is to bring people back to their senses. You know, it's one thing to say that you don't believe in morality, in right and wrong, but it's another thing to live that way. I remember talking to a student on a college campus, and he told me he thought that what Hitler did in killing 6 million Jews wasn't necessarily wrong. And so I looked at him right in the eye, and I said, you know, it must be hard to live your life that way, though, huh? And you could see the wind just went right out of his sail, and he realized that what he said he believed, he couldn't actually live that way. And to prove that happened is the last thing he said to me is this: well, you know, maybe someday I'll go back to church. You know, and that's what we need to do sometimes, is bring people back to their senses in our conversations with them. Everything can't be so critical. There can't be, you know, we can't say we can't know anything, because even the statement, I can't know anything, is an absolute statement. And we just need to gently, graciously talk to our friends in such a way to help them begin to build planks to the gospel, helping them to acknowledge the fact, yes, there are some things that they do believe in. After 9/11, I talked to many non-believers who said to me, you know, I used to think it didn't matter what I believed, but after 9/11, I know now it does matter what I believe. And see, if it matters what you believe, then not everyone can be right. And if not everyone can be right, then somebody has to be wrong. And this is the kind of conversation that we need to have with our non-believing friends, to help them to take those steps back to their senses and back to the cross, step by step.
Well, we're talking with Dr. David Geisler, author of the book Conversational Evangelism. And again, if you have some questions about evangelism, I know some people out there must have questions about evangelism. This is a great opportunity to ask them, what are the obstacles you face when it comes to evangelism? Maybe we can help you find some ways to get past those obstacles. So what is it that keeps you from doing it? Let us help you figure out how you can get past that. And if you'd like to ask your question, call in 1-866-730-4921. It's toll-free, so no matter where you are, you can just give us a call. It won't cost you a thing. 1-866-730-4921.
You know, and there's one thing when it comes to evangelism that I've noticed, and I noticed this in my own life when I first became a Christian. We have that calling to be evangelists. I don't care who it is, because I have heard some people say, well, that's not my calling. As believers, it's all of our calling, and we may not be called to, you know, overseas missions, but we are all called to evangelize. The problem, seems to me, is that we don't really know why, which is kind of sad, and I can say that of my own life for a long period of time is, you know, it was kind of like an obligation to me. And David, I know that in the book Conversational Evangelism, you touch on this a little bit, why it's so hard for believers to even realize that we need to be evangelizing. Can you kind of touch on some of those? Because I know you gave three main points near the end of your book for why, really, it's so hard for Christians to even begin that process. Can you explain some of those for us?
Well, I think we need to begin to see evangelism as more than an obligation. I think there are three things that I talk about in the book that I think are barriers to being more effective in our witness to other people, our compassion for the lost. One of them is maybe we're not really convinced of the truth of Christianity. I remember talking to a student on a college campus, and he said, I'm a Christian, but I'm not sure in my faith. And I asked him why. He said, well, I believe Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, but I don't believe it's strong enough that I'm willing to share it with another person. And so, you know, for some of us, we see it as an obligation, and yeah, we're not even convinced ourselves if it's really true. You know, with Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code and all the things that people are saying now, maybe we're having questions ourselves. And Jesus said in John 8:32, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. So my encouragement is, you know, find the answer. So that's on one level. That may be one barrier. But I find that one of the reasons why we don't share our faith, and maybe we see it as an obligation, is we don't realize the degree in which we've been forgiven. You see, if we've been forgiven a great debt, then we will realize the degree in which God loves us. And if we're experience that love, then we can't help but want to share that love with other people. And maybe we just forget. Maybe we've been a Christian for too long. We forget just how much God must have loved us to forgiven us. And so we need to understand that we don't try to pay back God in a sense of duty. Love can't be paid back. It can only be passed on. And so if we've experienced God's love, we won't be able to help but share that love with other people, but maybe we've just forgotten. We've lost our first love. Remember what Jesus said to the sinful woman? He was forgiven little, loves little. He was forgiven much, loves much. And then the other thing I think that we need to remember that may get in the way is I think we forget the sense of urgency. I think we forget this eternal perspective. We get so caught up in our daily lives that we forget what is really important. You know, look at the stock market, you know, it goes up, it goes down. What are we investing our time and energy in? Are we investing in something that's going to pay eternal dividends, you know? And we need to understand there's an urgency to the task that God has called us to do. And if we don't understand that, maybe we're not going to be motivated, and we're not going to get beyond this sense of, yes, I'm obligated to share the good news. It's more than an obligation. It's a great responsibility, but it's a great privilege for you and I to have an impact to change eternity. And I just think we need to keep that in mind as we think about what God has called us to do every day in terms of our witness with our non-Christian friends.
Definitely. And David, actually, you reminded me of something that I had thought about earlier today as I was, you know, I was going through the end of the book and really just thinking about why we aren't excited about sharing our faith. A lot of times it really is.
Because it's scary.
It's scary, but something that, I mean, I truly believe it was God just reminding me of this, was that, I mean, if you really think about the way, say with music, say you find a really good artist, and I know a lot of people can relate to this, especially listening to radio right now, you find a really good artist that changes your life, and you want to share it with everybody. I mean, every single person that you come across, it's like, oh, man, have you heard this artist? You know, check out their MySpace, check out their Facebook, whatever. And it just, I mean, really struck me, because I know that I do that. I know, you know, my Facebook status all the time has links to different artists, but...
It's too bad Jesus doesn't have a Facebook.
I know, right? He has a MySpace, though.
Does he have a MySpace?
He does have a MySpace.
You're making this up.
I'm not making this up.
Really?
I promise.
How did he get a MySpace?
I have no idea. Satan has one, too, apparently.
What? Wow.
Anyways, we're
getting off topic. My bad.
But really, I mean, if we could muster enough excitement, the same amount, if not, I mean, not the same amount, even more excitement than we have for the music that we hear, the movies that we watch, and even, golly, even the friends that we meet, that we want other people to meet this person because they're really cool. If we could come up with that much excitement and just, I mean, just really take that to, I mean, maybe step one, take it to your family and your friends, those who are around you every day, because let's face it, it's really scary to walk up to a complete stranger and start sharing the gospel with them. But really, I mean, we all have those people in our lives that we know aren't saved. And if we could just get up enough excitement for that, just to share it with them. You know, David, something that you pointed out in your book is we're not called to, you know, give the prayer with everybody. We're not called to lead every single person to Christ, but instead to bring Christ to every single person and just being able to share that with them.
The way I define evangelism in the book is this way, is evangelism is every day and in every way helping our non-believing friends to take one step closer to Jesus Christ. I mean, you know, it may be just a small step, but you know, that's all part of evangelism. Let me just give you an example. Just a couple of weeks ago, I was talking to this Chinese gal here in Singapore, and I've talked to her several times in the past, and I found out in talking to her in the past, she calls herself a free thinker, okay? She hasn't come to any conclusions about Christianity or religion in general. But I sensed 2 weeks ago there was something different. So I asked her this question. I said, you know, as a free thinker, do you think there is anything different about Jesus compared to, you know, any other religious leader? And she thought about it and said, yeah. I asked her, well, what do you think about Jesus? She said, well, that's a hard one. It's hard to really know kind of, you know, what to think about him. And so I kept probing a little further because I sensed that she was more and more open. I said, do you believe that Jesus, in fact, did miraculous things and, in fact, died on the cross and rose from the dead? And she thought about it for a moment and said, yeah, I do believe that. I do believe that Jesus died and rose from the dead. Why did he do that? Why did he die on the cross? So essentially, she asked me for an opportunity to share the gospel with her. And so for the first time in her life, I was able to share that, you know, Jesus did that. He died on the cross because he loves us and wants a relationship with us. And I explained to her what the sacrificial lamb was in the Old Testament, how Jesus was our sacrificial lamb who died on the cross to take the penalty for us. He was, in a sense, our substitute. And I used Larry Moyer's illustration about cancer. I said, let's just call her Mary. I said, Mary, let's just say you have terminal cancer. What's going to happen to you most likely? You're going to die, right? What Jesus did for you is he took your terminal cancer cells and he put it in his own body. What happened to Jesus? He died, right? Yes. What happened to you? You lived, right? Yeah. That's what it means for Jesus to be our substitute. And so for the first time in her life, she got to hear a clear presentation of the gospel, and I got to explain what sin is, and I gave her a little track that talks about the relationship between Chinese words in the Old Testament, the Old Testament in Chinese words, like the word for redemption in Chinese literally means lamb over me.
Wow.
So there are a lot of bridges in Chinese culture to the Bible, and just helping her to understand that, you know, Christianity is not foreign. It's really more Eastern than Western, and helping her to understand really what Christianity is all about. But, you know, I've had several conversations with her in the past, and she has never been open to going very far. But I have not tried to push those doors open. That's the point I'm trying to make here,
right.
Is I wait for the Spirit to tell me when it's right to take the next step. And that's what you and I need to do, is be sensitive with our friends or family members or coworkers to know when the Holy Spirit wants us to take that next step and help that person take another step closer to Christ.
Conversational Evangelism is the name of the book. We're talking with Dr. David Geisler. It's conversationalevangelism.com if they want more info on the book, right, Dr. Geisler?
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And when I was...
And some more resources, too, that
right.
they can follow up after they read the book.
Now, when we were getting ready for this, there was something I was thinking about. I had an experience a few years back where I got to be a counselor at a Billy Graham crusade. And, you know, I wanted to experience that. It was one of the last times that Billy Graham was coming through this area, and I thought it'd be cool to be a part of that and see him one last time. And I had the opportunity to be a counselor for when people, you know, went forward to accept the Lord, which is, you know, part of what happens at a Billy Graham crusade. And I was all excited for that. And, you know, he went through this week-long training of how to, you know, counsel people and talk with them and pray with them and all that stuff. And I was all amped. And then, the crusade started. And the first night, you know, I go down the floor and all these people came down. I was like, oh, this is great. I'm going to get a chance to, you know, pray with someone so they can, know Christ. And I talked to this guy. It's like, so, you come down to accept Christ for the first time, huh? No, I'm already a Christian. Oh, okay. Well, why are you down here? Well, you know, I wanted to see what it'd be like to come down during a Billy Graham crusade. Like, oh, okay. So that was the first night, kind of disappointing. The second night is the same thing. Another Christian. Like every night during that crusade, I didn't talk to one person who was coming forward to accept Christ for the first time. It was either a rededication or just wanted to try it at a Graham crusade. And one of the things that has bugged me about that ever since then. Because you keep hearing people say, most people accept Christ before the age of 18. You know, that time period is usually when people are most malleable and can have their beliefs shaped, and usually that is the most fruitful time to accept Christ. Yet, it seems that most of our evangelistic efforts are focused on people past that age, i.e. the Billy Graham crusade, and the more I reflect on it, the more I realize, well, I didn't meet one person that was changed by that. Not to say that it didn't happen. You know, I've read Billy Graham's autobiography. He changed a lot of people's lives. But it's interesting, if you read his autobiography, considering the numbers of people who went to his crusades, the actual fraction of people who came forward and accepted Christ for the first time, I was actually surprised going through that, saying, that, you know, it's thousands, but considering how many people went to hear him, that's a small fraction. And so... What I wanted to ask you, Dr. Geisler, is not that you can ever focus on the wrong area with your evangelism, but are we missing something by focusing so much on, you know, apologetics and debating and doing all this stuff for older people as opposed to focusing more on the younger generation? Are we missing out on that by waiting until after they're 18 and then start evangelizing them? And I don't know. I mean, what do you think about how the age breakdown goes and how our evangelism breakdown goes with who we're focusing on?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I've seen those statistics, and it's unfortunate that we wait to people have crisis in their life in their college ages,
right.
and even in high school till we start to do anything and bother with them. Seems like that we should be reaching them when they're in grade school. And I've seen the statistics, and it seems like we, you know, we should really refocus our priorities in the church and put more of our money and energy in our youth, and especially, you know, in grade school and junior high and high school, and so that by the time they get to college, they're solid.
Right.
They're solid Christians. They know how, they know what they believe and why they believe it, by their words and by the way that they live their life. They're living testimony to other people. And so I totally agree with you. I think that we, you know, really need to change our focus in terms of overall as a church. What is it that we're trying to do? But I do know that there are people that do come to Christ even as an adult. I was teaching this methodology to a church 3 weeks ago, and a lady applied one of the principles, and a week later she led two older ladies to the Lord.
Nice.
So, you know, I know it happens.
Yeah.
But statistically, the emphasis really should be in our youth, I think.
Well, if the focus should be more on our youth, one of the things I was wondering as I was reading this, and all this is kind of a recent revelation to me,
mm-hmm.
you know, because kind of breaking out the old standard mold of how we do evangelism,
right.
you know, more and more recently I've been thinking, how do we do this for younger people? And as I was reading your book, Dr. Geisler, one of the things that kept coming back to me is like, how do we apply this pre-evangelism, this conversational evangelism idea to reaching kids? And I figured, well, he's going to be on the program, so I might as well just ask him.
Mm-hmm.
How can we apply the concepts that you use in this book to reach kids who are in grade school or middle school or high school? I mean, what's an effective way to do that for the younger generation?
Well, I think we probably need to begin by teaching people to be better listeners. That's one of the things that I talk about in the book, that as Christians, we don't really listen very carefully to our non-Christian friends. And so a lot of times we miss important details about their life. And, you know, I don't know if you remember this from the old TV detective shows, but remember Detective Columbo?
Yeah, he always had
and
like
he
a
would,
squint.
You know, bumble around and just kind of ask questions and kind of catch people in their inconsistencies.
That's
well,
right.
You know, we just need to ask people questions in a way to kind of create interest in continuing the conversation. And like with, you know, we need to teach our youth to listen to their friends and ask them questions about, you know, what's meaningful in their life? What, you know, is it just, you know, games and things like that? Is there other things in their life? We need just to talk to them in such a way to find out what their interests are. And then from those interests, then create a bridge to the gospel or to a spiritual conversation. I mean, that's what Jesus did with the woman at the well. You know, he bridged from her interest talking about water. And so, you know, we find out, you know, what's the latest movie the kids are watching, and then build a bridge from there. Like when the Da Vinci Code came out, you know, one of the questions I encourage college students to ask their friends about the Da Vinci Code is this. Is that, you know, do you realize that there are two pillars of Christianity that Dan Brown didn't even question in his book? One is that God existed and that Jesus really did die on the cross. And then ask him this question. I'm just curious, what do you think? Is there any other natural way to explain the empty tomb and yet believe that Jesus was just a man? These are the kinds of questions that we can ask our friends. Now, certainly that's more of a high school question than a grade school question, but we just need to find out what people's interests are in terms of their movies or ideas, and then try to think of questions that we could ask them that would create more of an interest in spiritual matters. And then once they're open to more talking about spiritual ideas, then a key question we can ask them is just this. I'm just curious, have you come to any conclusions about Jesus Christ? And this is exactly the same question I asked this Chinese gal 2 weeks ago, is, as a free thinker, have you come to any conclusions about Jesus? I remember on a college campus I was talking to a Hindu student one day, and he said he was very comfortable with his Hindu beliefs. And I said, you know, I'm really happy for you, but I have just one question for you. What are you going to do with Jesus in your Hindu beliefs? Because Jesus just didn't claim to be just like any other prophet. And so once people are interested in spiritual dialogue, then we can help them to begin to understand, you know, what makes Jesus stand apart. Jesus Christ is the only major religious leader who ever claimed to be God, who lived a sinless life, fulfilled prophecy, died on the cross, and rose from the dead. And sometimes I just use that little phrase in talking to people especially people who are pluralistic, because they think there's no difference between Christianity and other religions, and just ask them that question. Do you think there are really any differences between Christianity and other religions? And do you know how Jesus is different compared to Buddha or Muhammad or some other religious leaders? And just try to get people to think a little bit. Unfortunately, we're raised in a generation now where we don't think very much, do we?
Yeah, no, that's the truth. That's why I do a program like this, to get people thinking. And if you're thinking right now and you're thinking, I don't get it, and want to ask a question, 1-866-730-4921 to call in as we talk with Dr. David Geisler, author of the book Conversational Evangelism. I'm trying to figure out some way to use the Jonas Brothers as an evangelistic tool, you know?
Oy.
I mean, there's like a whole segment of the tween society right there. If you could use them as a bridge, there's got to be a way.
Exactly.
Don't you think so,
exactly.
Man?
I have nothing that I can say that's positive about that. I'm sorry. I have a lot of mid-school girls really upset with me right now. I'm sorry, ladies.
Well, it just seems like that's like one of those phenomenons. Like, man, if you can find a way to use that as a bridge, there's got to be a way, because the Jonas Brothers are touching millions
of
lives.
Death.
Bridge of death.
Right.
Nice.
And one of the things I talk about in the book, I don't know if you remember this, is there are three D's we have to keep in mind in asking questions in a postmodern, post-Christian world where people get easily offended by what we say about Christ. We need to learn how to ask questions in a way that surface doubt, that minimize defensiveness, but most importantly, they create a desire to either continue the conversation or to hear more about Jesus. Now, let me give you an example to illustrate this whole idea of how to surface doubt and at the same time minimize defensiveness. I was talking to a guy here in the exercise room a while back here in Singapore, and I was trying to remember where I was in my last conversation with him spiritually. That's how I always try to build upon where I was in my last conversation. I said, oh, yeah, by the way, what church did you say you go to? He said, I go to such and such Catholic church. He paused for a moment and said, we believe in Mary. So I asked him, well, what do you mean by we believe in Mary? And he thought about it and stumbled over his words, but finally said something like this. Well, we believe that Mary makes up what Jesus lacks. Now, at that point, I could have said to him, well, you know, the Bible doesn't teach that. But what would have happened? He would have just got defensive, right, and probably
turned
away from me.
Yeah, he would have gotten defensive with what I would have done, too.
Right?
I would have said, what? Yeah. Oh, my gosh, you're crazy. That probably wouldn't have been the best approach, though.
So what I did is this. I asked him this question. I said, do you know what 1 Timothy 2:5 says? He said, no. I said, 1 Timothy 2:5 says this. There's only one God and one mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus. And then I asked another question. What do you think this verse teaches?
Right.
See, I wasn't spoon-feeding him. I was asking him, allowing him to try to surface the truth for himself. And he stumbled over his words, and I said, well, doesn't this teach that there's God and there's man and there's one mediator, and that is the person, Jesus Christ? And he thought about it for a moment, and he said, yes. Yes, that's what that verse teaches. So now here's what I said to him after that. I said, you know, certainly I could see how some Catholics could consider Mary as being a helpful person who could pray for them, just as maybe some Baptists might be helpful if they got Billy Graham to pray for them. So I kind of, you know, wasn't trying to downgrade the importance of Mary and respect for Mary in the Catholic tradition. But here's the question I asked them. I said, but can Mary do anything to help you atone for your sins in any way? He thought about it for a moment. He said, no, she can't. Now, you see, I just helped him take a step closer. Now, from the other things that he said after that, I could see he wasn't really ready to go further that day, so I didn't push him any further. But you see, I helped him to surface the truth for himself, and in the process, I minimized his defensiveness in our conversation by how I talked to him. And that's what we need to do. Then the other thing we need to do is we need to create a curiosity then to want to continue the conversation. Let me give you one other example. I was talking to a Chinese lady one day, and she was telling me how wonderful Buddhism is. And in Buddhism, I don't know if you know this, you're not supposed to desire anything if you're a pure Buddhist. And I asked her, I said, but don't you desire good things for your children. Now, I listened to her talk for 10 minutes about how wonderful Buddhism is, and then I asked her that question, and she looked like a deer caught in the headlights, and she said, well, I've only been a Buddhist for a year. You should talk to my mother.
Nice.
Oh, no.
And so I deconstructed one of her beliefs, but then I created curiosity. I said this to her. I said, do you know what Jesus taught about the issue of desire the Buddha was so concerned about? She said, no, I don't. I said, see, Jesus taught that the answer was not to give up on desire, but to develop the right desire. And seeing as a Christian, I believe when we invite Christ to come into our life, he can change us from the inside out. So we no longer desire to do the bad things. We desire to do the good things that God wants us to do. Now, you see, I surfaced her doubt, but I created a curiosity, at least, for her to want to know what Jesus thought about the issue of desire, and that opened the door for me to share part of the gospel. And that's what we need to learn the art of, and that's what the book is all about, is to teach people how to learn to listen, to ask questions, to uncover barriers, and build a bridge to the gospel with people using the example of the musician, the artist, the archaeologist, and the builder as an imagery to help people get a hold of the idea.
David, just touching on something that you were talking about there about not causing people to be defensive, and I've noticed this is a common occurrence with me on the show, is that I have to kind of give a little shout out to everybody in my generation and really challenge them or make them upset, whichever one you want, whichever you prefer. But something I've really...
Which generation is your generation?
Oh, okay, sorry. I'm 20
generation
years
Y,
old.
Generation X, generation Y not? I mean, which generation?
Generation make people upset generation.
Oh, okay, well, okay. Generation apathy?
Yeah.
Okay.
But something that I've really noticed, and something that's really disheartening for me, and I was a part of this for a long time, and I still struggle with it sometimes, is we have this tendency to try to tear somebody else's beliefs down as much as we can, and not in a nice way. And I've noticed this not only with the way that Christians in my my age group, not only in the way that they confront non-believers, but also in the way they confront other believers. And it's really sad for me to watch this. Again, me being one that was there, because it's almost like we believe that we have to completely tear somebody down in every way. And these are, I mean, people base who they are off of their beliefs. That's just the way it works. And to tear down somebody's beliefs in such a way that is hurtful is a direct and personal attack to that person. So this, just kind of shouting this out to everybody in my age group, first of all, the passion that's there that I see is such a great thing, and I think it's such a great thing that has been given to us by God. Because we are a very passionate generation. I see that.
Right.
Golly, non-believers, believers, we just are. That's just the way we are. The downfall to that is that we have passion without having a good understanding for how to be loving. And that can be really, really hurtful. And so I really want to, you know, kind of challenge people who want to get out there. It seems to me like a lot of people in my age group don't really have a fear of going up to a complete stranger and talking to them, because we are a very communal generation. However, we do have that issue of confronting too strongly at times. And so I was really happy that you touched on that in the book, because that was something, like I said, that I used to struggle with greatly. Is something where you really have to approach them in love. And that goes back to, you know, why are you doing it in the first place? Do you want to just prove yourself right, or are you doing it out of love?
What we need to help people, I think Christians understand, is our goal is, when we talk to our friends, is not to win the argument or to show that we're right and they're wrong. The goal is to remove the obstacle, whatever it is, intellectual, emotional, spiritual, whatever the obstacle is, so that we can help people take a step closer to Jesus Christ. You know, I'll be honest with you. I used to argue with people about apologetic issues, but you know, I don't do that anymore. And I just discovered that's a waste of time. It's a waste of their time, and it's a waste of my time. I just want to talk to people in a way to maybe answer any questions that they may have, in a way to help them take a step closer to Christ. I don't care if they understand, to try to win the argument. I don't care about those things. And I will leave a conversation sometimes not saying as much as I could, because I think we need to have a different perspective in using apologetics. My father, taught me this when I was young. He said, you don't go to war with a pea shooter, but you don't go to target practice with a bazooka. And that's overkill.
Right.
And unfortunately, sometimes as Christians, you know, we throw our evidence and we argue with people and we win the battle, maybe. But unfortunately, we lose the war. And Paul said in 1 Corinthians 13, though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, I am nothing. And so we better be clear that when we talk to our friends, that we're coming across in a loving way. And that's one of the most important things that we can communicate when we share the gospel, is that we're doing it out of a sense of love and concern, not out of a desire to prove that we're right and they're wrong, or that we're smarter, or we're better than them, or anything like that. We need to help people understand that Christianity is one beggar telling another beggar where to find bread, and that's it. There's nothing special about us. Just there's something special about Jesus. And therefore, because there's something special about Jesus and we have a relationship with us, then there's something special about us.
Speaking of your generation, Mandy, I think there's a unique obstacle to the up-and-coming generations, mine included, to a certain extent, that we have to overcome. I think we're losing the art of conversation, period.
That's true.
We communicate through Facebook, text message, instant messaging, email, and yeah, I'm not making this up. I have observed on this campus people going around looking down at their phones more than they do making eye contact at anyone who's walking around.
Twittering and not conversation.
It's scary. Well, and here's why I'm concerned about this. When I was observing people walking around on campus like that, and it's not just this camp, everywhere I go, the thing, but on a church campus, the thing that kind of made me concerned was, how are you going to notice anybody's need if you're too busy doing whatever it is you're doing on your phone?
Mm-hmm.
You're always looking down. I've been to meetings with youth pastors, and all the youth pastors are listening right now like, oh, don't do this, yo. Yes, I'm going to do this. Where we're sitting there in the youth pastors meeting, and half the youth pastors, while the meeting's going on, like, oh, like, okay, I understand that, you know, we are much more multitask-orientated, and we can do more than one thing at a time and all that type of stuff. But when it comes to doing what we're talking about here, this evangelism thing, seems to me like you need 100% of your attention focused on it. I can't imagine that when you're trying to build a bridge to someone, that they're going to feel like you're very genuine. When you're like, hey, did you know that you need Jesus Christ? And while you're looking down at your phone, you know, moving your thumbs around, text messaging someone else. We're like, yeah, dude, I'm telling you, he loves you. He really does. Yeah, oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry you're having a hard time. That sucks, dude. Yeah, hold on just a second. I got to take this. What? What? Oh, dude, that was awesome. Okay, bye. And
right.
It just seems to me that before we can be effective at this, we got to learn how to control our desire to constantly be using all of our little gadgets to, quote unquote, stay in touch.
Right. You know, and one of the things that really, I mean, like you're talking about, really just not being focused on listening, which was, you know, one
we're
of the first points
in this book. We're
not focused on people. Exactly.
Period.
And I can tell you that in the past, golly, I don't even know how long, that the easiest time for me personally to witness to somebody verbally in a conversation was when I'd gone on a run with my dogs, and I had run into a guy just in a park, random guy in a park who had another dog, and they were all messing around, and I was able to just start talking to him about, you know, his love for his dogs, and somehow that turned into just a really, you know, spiritual conversation. I say spiritual because, you know, he was sharing his beliefs on a non-personal God and how he just put us all here. And one of the things that I was able to talk to him about, and this is, you know, with no phone in my hand, with no, you know.
Did you forget it?
Watch? No, it was all in my house. It was something that, you know, I don't run with my phone or anything, so.
You left it behind on purpose?
Yeah,
well, I know. People are going to think
pretty,
you're weird.
I am kind of weird. You know, I don't even have texting. It's kind of crazy.
What? Wow.
but really just to be able to sit there and talk with him and really just take his love for his dogs and put that kind of take that and spin it around to the love that God has given us through him, that God is love, the one that gave us that love that we can have, really, And I can say flat out, if I had had my phone, I don't text or anything, but I'm constantly checking the time on my phone. Right. I don't know why. It's a disease.
Well, I was going to ask
you, what's going on.
Do you think the conversation would have gone as well if you had those distractions?
I don't think it would have.
Oh, wait. I'm sorry. Distractions. Most people think they're necessities.
No, my bad. It's a total distraction sometimes. We are not afraid to say it.
How do you feel about this very unique 21st century problem that is really developing, David, where people are so attached to communicating electronically? You know, all the advice that you gave in your book was really good, but I was thinking, people don't know how to do this anymore unless they have a keyboard in front of their face. How are we supposed to learn this if we're too busy trying to... We can't even spell anymore because the way we shorthand...
Jesus hearts you.
Well, yeah. I think you can start where people are at, okay? If people use text messaging and Twitter and all that, we'll start with that and have conversations with your friends and ask them, like in the book, we talk about this, listening, I guess I could call it reading, and asking questions, asking clarifying questions. What do you mean by this, or what do you mean by this? Just to kind of create a better understanding of where that person is coming from and helping them to understand where they're coming from. So I think we could still do evangelism on, you know, on the web. We just need to use whatever tools that we're comfortable with and whatever conversations we're comfortable with people. I don't think we have to verbally talk to people. If people, I've learned that people feel actually more comfortable sharing what they really believe when they're hidden behind, a computer wall,
right. Yeah.
So to speak.
Yep.
You know?
That's true.
And they'll say things about their life and things like that. I mean, look at everything that people are doing to plaster on their blog, all these personal information that they make out open to the public. And the other thing I wanted to add is that I think, why is it that everyone is trying to connect? Mm-hmm. You know? What is it we're trying to connect with? It seems to me this is part of the postmodern generation we live in. We live in a generation which basically says there is no reality, everything is a construct, and yet we fight against that. We want to connect. And why is reality TV so popular? Well, it's because the most real thing that we can think of is another human being that has real sorrows, real joys, and we can connect with that kind of thing. And I think that we should understand what is the sign of what's going on, you know, what's happening today. Why are people doing what they're doing? And I think one of the reasons they're doing what they're doing is they have this heart longing. Pascal says there's this God-shaped vacuum in the heart of every person that cannot be fulfilled by anything, but only by God made known through Jesus Christ. And we need to help them to begin to understand this vacuum that they try to fill it with and try to connect with, ultimately will be unfulfilling. Only through a relationship with Jesus Christ will their life be fulfilling. Now, that doesn't mean you won't have problems or trials,
right,
but hey, you'll have a sense of meaning and purpose to your life. And this is one of the things we talk about in our book and also on our website at meekness and truth.org, that people need to get a handle on how to talk to people about these kinds of issues, especially as it relates to postmodern issues today.
I think one of the things I've been observing that I find really fascinating in today's society is the more we try to connect through all these different ways that we have to connect electronically, the more isolated people feel and the more desperate and alone that they feel. And it's
exactly.
an absolutely
exactly.
fascinating thing to see. And David, you're absolutely right. It is a great opportunity to dive in there and say, I know what you're looking for.
Thanks for joining us on Raw Talk on M88. Get the podcast of tonight's show free at M88.org. And join us again next week for more Raw Talk on M88.